Welcome to the NutriTots podcast. We're your hosts, Megan and Haley Arnold. As clinicians and moms, we are in the trenches with you dealing with the fun and sometimes ugly truth of growing a healthy family. Our goal is to empower a community through nutrition. Join us as we dive into topics related to conception, pregnancy, and raising kids. Thanks for listening. We're excited to have you with us.
Welcome to the NutriTots podcast, everyone. Today, we're so excited because we have our very favorite educator in the world. Her name is Lynn, and she is here to talk to us about movement and play-based therapies for education. So one of the things here is, you know, most people come to listen to us because we talk about nutrition. But when it comes to the NutriTots podcast, anything and everything is fair game, from healthcare to education to, you know, playing outside. We'll talk about all of it. So Lynn Cacara, welcome to the NutriTots podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Haley. It's great to be here.
So tell us, you know, I can go on and on about how awesome you are, but tell us about yourself. You are obviously a rock star educator with many degrees, but you have a very specific story about why you do what you do. Can you tell us more about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So my background in education is in early childhood, in elementary, and that's where I spent the last 20 plus years in the classroom as a curriculum coordinator, as a director of a preschool. But I think my real story in education starts when my son was born. There's that quote that says, you know, our children are our real teachers if we're humble enough to accept those lessons. And I always saw that quote, but I never really knew what it meant until I had my son. And I would realize pretty quickly that there was something going on that was different, and I couldn't put my finger on it. But I jokingly say that a worried mom does more research than the FBI. So I stayed up very late nights, trying not to go down the Google trail, but trying to figure out what might be happening. And luckily, I had some great resources at my fingertips, being in the world of education, and had my son evaluated and quickly learned at about a year that he had some sensory processing challenges. And while I had children in the classroom that presented in this way, it was new to me as a parent of what to do at home. And so what I saw with him was that everyday things were really scary. So typically, you know, you think as a new parent, you're going to have this child and you're going to give them all these exciting experiences and they're going to love it and be joyful. And you know, the world is just this place full of curiosity and excitement. Well, that was not our experience. Our experience was that everyday things were too loud and too scary and too itchy and had too much flavor, all the twos. And so I had a sensory avoider is what I would come to learn. And I'm incredibly lucky because as I learned to try and figure out how to cope as a parent, I was working with one of my schools. So I work as an inquiry coach. So I work as someone who does professional development with teachers, and I help teachers create more hands-on learning for kids. Okay. That's what I've done for the past 20 years. It's the idea of making school cool, where kids want to come. They're like, school is cool. I want to go. I want to be there. I don't want to miss a day. And that's really been my quest. So I partner with different nonprofit organizations, and I help schools to kind of re-envision what school can be, what it could be, what it should be, using the newest research that's out there to make that happen. And as I was working with one of my schools there, I had been there over the course of about 5 years, and the head of school at that time, she followed me on social media and she said, oh, you know, you have so many great photos and looks like everything's wonderful. And it was that moment where I got really vulnerable and opened up and shared, like, no, actually, it's really hard and it's not at all what I envisioned. And everything's scary. Everything's difficult. Everything is a challenge. And I don't know how to work through this. And it was one of those serendipitous moments of being in the right place at the right time. She said, do you know this book? And she held up this book right here. And I did indeed know this book, A Secret No More. because I, in my quest to learn more, I had flown out to the Star Institute in Denver, Colorado, and they're the leading institute internationally for sensory processing. And there, the founder of the institute, who was the author of this book, was the co-author of a woman who happened to work at the school I was in at that moment. So the head of school marched me down to her office and she said, Lynn, meet Dorit. And I walked in and she hugged me and said, don't worry, we're going to figure this out. And that was the beginning, really, of what would change the course of my professional career. Living on a small island in Hilton Head, I didn't have the care that I was hoping for from an occupational therapist standpoint. And so being your child's therapist is never the ideal situation at all, but I knew I needed to learn. Yeah. I knew I just needed to learn more to help him. So she started training me on Sundays. So in my free time, I was reading everything I could get my hands on and just really started diving into the world of occupational therapy. And I had this huge aha as an educator. And I thought, my goodness, I have an undergrad in early childhood. I have two master's degrees in education, and I've never come across any of this brain research about how children learn and setting the foundations for learning and what to do with dysregulated children. And I saw dysregulated children all the time in front of me in the classroom. It was really in front of my face at home 24/7, but I kept thinking like, wow, there's so many simple strategies and simple things we can be doing in the classroom and that we can educate parents on that aren't a part of back to school nights. They're not a part of the school newsletter that goes home. And as I started talking to my colleagues more in the field, I realized no one knew what I was talking about. That unless there was an occupational therapist at a specific school, this was not part of the strategies that teachers were presented with for how to best help children learn, how to set that kind of brain's architecture from a very young age, why play is so important and free play at that. A lot of times we disguise play. And so we might have some outcome as an adult we want kids to do, like we want them to learn their spelling words. So we're going to give them this game that they get to play. That's not free play. That's adults manipulating the play with a specific outcome in mind. Free play is when we truly trust children and we trust them to be capable and competent. And so we give them the space, we give them the agency, we're hands off, we set the opportunities, and we back off and we watch and we see what their play tells us as to what we can do differently. That's a big paradigm shift for most schools where we have this kind of top-down directive where we as educators have outcomes we need children to master at a certain time, which is pretty ludicrous, right? Like we would never say that all children who are 4 must wear size 4T. But yet in a classroom, we say, just because you're 4, you must all master these over the course of this school year alone. So we have a lot of that in the United States. It's why I appreciate my work that's international is because in other countries, we see bans. So in a 3-year band, here's what we hope children will achieve or master. It's not this 1-year fixed period of time. So it just allows for more natural growth and development. And so what I would learn, the more I dove into the reading, the more I dove into the research, I realized that I wanted to be someone, I had this platform. I work with schools all across the US and internationally regularly. I had this platform that I wanted to use to, there's so many moms of sensory kiddos, but they might be working in different fields that don't allow them to have a voice to advocate other than for their own child. And so I realized that I wanted to take my world as an inquiry coach and parlay it into something that better equipped schools for the children, just the really diverse children that we have in front of us. And realizing that as we look at this decline of play in the United States, that especially exacerbated during COVID, with closed playgrounds and kind of this lack of developmental movement, as children weren't moving in the community, they weren't having play dates, they were at home, perhaps in small apartments, just not having that freedom to move, that we see a decline in play, and with that decline in play is a rise in sensory issues. And so helping schools better understand that connection and better understand the really simple things that they can do in the classroom and promote at home with families has been the quest that I've been on the last couple of years.
That is absolutely fascinating. You kind of have a similar story as we do because, you know, we've got two little ones that are 4 and 3. Your son's what, 7 now? Or is he 8?
7.
Getting so big. So we're just now at the point of, oh my gosh, we have to choose a preschool. We have to do, you know, we've literally toured like 6 schools the past couple of weeks to try to figure out the best fit for our kiddos. And walking in, realizing our kids are not going to excel here because there's no outdoor time. There's no, you know, freedom to play time. And even when they say it is, it doesn't really feel like it's playful. And our kids are wild hyenas that are not ready to sit still and, you know, be your typical student, I should say. They are still learning their environment. They're still learning who they are. So it's fascinating to me. And you recently just gave a keynote speaking gig in Tahoe, right? And I want to dive into this because I think what you have to say is fascinating. Your whole premise is that the body is the brain's first teacher. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's so fascinating how the brain and the body work together. And so when you look at young children and the development there, the body tells the brain everything it needs to know. So you talked about your kids exploring their environment. That's exactly what young children do to understand the world around them. Young children are actually the best scientists that exist because they're always exploring. They're so curious. They have all these questions. And so they move their body. And every time they move in some way, that's setting the foundation for the brain's learning. And so anytime we inhibit movement, we are actually decreasing the brain's architecture. And so what I mean by that is that we learn through our senses, and we know that by thinking about children's play when they're really little, we give them all these different experiences with textures that they can touch and play in and with. And we tend to think of it, and I still see units designed in classroom time after time again when I go in to do curriculum work, and it's about the 5 senses. And I'm like, ah, no, what if there was another way? And when we actually look at how children learn and how the body instructs the brain, there's actually 7 senses. And in fact, there's conversation right now about that 7 becoming 8 for the purposes of us, of that interception. But in terms of brain development, that 7 senses is really key. So we all know the 5, the sound, sight, taste, touch, smell, but the other 2 are ones that I routinely ask educators about, and they kind of look at me sideways, like, tell me about the other 2. So it's proprioception and vestibular. And so if we think about how we learn from a vestibular system, vestibular meaning literally translated as vestibule to the brain, it is a sense that allows for a sense of balance. And so our vestibular system is actually, it begins in the inner ears, and it's those tiny little hairs in our ears, and we need fluid to go over those hairs regularly. Well, fluid doesn't go over those hairs in the position the 3 of us are in right now. We're upright with our heads sitting still. The way that vestibular system is developed is by moving the head in all different ways. So if we stop and we think about young children for a minute, if they see a hill, what are they immediately going to do?
Roll down it or run up it.
Absolutely. They're going to do one of those 2 things so that their head is in a different position. If they're on a swing, what do they often want to do? They want to take those top, the top hanging pieces, and they want to spin themselves on there. Kids love to spin and move. They want to hang upside down from things. And that's actually their body and their brain working together. Young children can't tell you, my body needs this right now. My brain needs this for development right now. They just do it. They know instinctively that this is what they need. And that sense, the more that sense is developed, the more you have a sense of balance. That's your emotional regulation. So when we see kids that are highly dysregulated, kids that are very easily frustrated or anxious or worried, they're the ones that kind of just have those meltdowns that appear to outsiders to be from nothing at all. I think three of us know this world very well with our kiddos.
Heaven forbid you ask them to put on their shoes.
Oh, right. To go to the place they want to go, right? Yeah. And so we see, I hear this from teachers all the time, and I felt it in my experience too. You know, we're seeing more and more kids who have like small zones of where they're comfortable. And outside of those zones, there are those meltdowns and those freakouts and that frustration. And so this is where that vestibular sense comes into play, is that the more we're moving the body, the more we're moving the head out of an upright position, the more we're creating balance in the brain and body. And not only that, when we look at brain development of how academic learning happens, the seven senses have to have a really strong foundation before you ever get up to academic learning at the top. So if that's our ultimate goal in schools, which I would argue it shouldn't be our ultimate goal in schools, that we need to look at skill development and emotional regulation at the same time of skills. You know, we're not, the goal of schools isn't to create workers of tomorrow. It's to suit students of today and who they are as citizens of the world today, as a 3-year-old, as a 7-year-old, as a 12-year-old. You know, we don't know the jobs that are going to be created 20 years from now. What we do have a sense of is the skills that are going to be needed. And those are the skills that can't be automated. Those are the things that technology can't take over for us. And so that's that brain development piece and what we used to call soft skills, but now are the skills moving forward, that collaboration, the communication, that flexible thinking, that ability to be agile and nimble in our thinking, to problem solve and problem pose. All of those happen when we're in a relaxed state of mind. Psychologists call it flow. When we're in that, that allows us to get to those skills. The more we've developed the seven senses, the more we have that strong foundation, that's where those skills can then develop from there. Teachers talk all the time about wanting children to have self-control, parents too. We can't have self-control without self-regulation. Self-regulation can't happen without a strong vestibular system. So what we want are places at school, spaces where kids, where we hold space for kids to be able to do that. And what I see on most playgrounds are pretty sterile places for play. I see swings that have been taken down. I see children who may only go down the slide, not up the slide. And let's talk about up the slide for a minute too. So not only is there the vestibular system, but there's proprioception as the seventh sense. And proprioception is knowing where your body is in space. And that seems pretty basic, but when we really get into how that affects brain development, it's pretty profound. Because right now, as we're sitting here talking, we're all sitting in chairs. We can feel that chair underneath us, perhaps behind us. Children and adults need to have these strong proprioception systems so they can do academic tasks like reading, where they're moving across the body. So the eye tracking that happens from left to right, they need to know where they are in space. Writing is the same way, to go across the body. A lot of times when we see children that have weak proprioceptive systems, those are your kids that are often your tacklers at recess. They're the kids that come in like a bull in a china store, where they come running in the morning to say hello to you. And that hug is this huge bear hug that knocks you over or knocks the other children over. They're not meaning to, they just don't have a sense of their body in relation or in connection to other things. So it's too much. And then we have kids with also very weak systems, and those tend to be your slumpers. They appear to be lazy in the classroom or at home, but it's really, they don't have a sense of where their body is and where that needs to be to do the tasks that are needed of them. And so a lot of times what I see in schools are programs, I see children being referred at a really early age for extra help. And it makes me a bit crazy as an early childhood educator, because when I see children referred anytime before the age of 7 for extra help, I want to know right away that those 7 senses have a strong foundation. And usually it's that proprioception and the vestibular. And I want to know that those are solid before I ever look at handwriting. So for example, like handwriting, there's a program in school called Handwriting Without Tears. Well, to me right away, the title tells you there's something wrong there. If we have to call anything without tears, maybe we shouldn't be doing it. But we do this really early on and we say, oh, kids have issues with handwriting and fine motor skills. They need more of it. Really, it's probably shoulder development, because writing happens in the shoulder and it works our way down the arm until it gets to the hands. So instead of more practice with a pencil at 3 or 4 years old, actually what we need to be doing are getting kids on monkey bars where they're hanging and they're gripping things. We need to have them doing, remember the old school wheelbarrow races?
Yeah.
That's what they need to be doing, where somebody's holding their legs and they're walking. Not only are you getting palmar pressure, pressure of the palms, which can be very calming to the brain, at the same time alerting and stimulating. Not only are we getting that, but we're getting that shoulder and that muscle development that needs to happen. So we have this idea in America in general that more earlier is better. And just because kids can do it, it doesn't mean we should be doing it to them. We're one of the only developed countries that starts formal reading instruction before the age of 7, even though all of the research tells us we're better off waiting until 7. So if we create environments that allow kids to move, their body will move in ways that it needs to all on their own to develop these senses, so that later we can have this academic foundation that we're looking for.
Fascinating. So, you know, Megan and I are chiropractors. So neurology is always one of those things we talk about all the time.
I know my brain is spinning. I was like, ooh, we could develop a curriculum.
For real. So with primitive reflex integration, like a lot of stuff, that's another podcast for another day. But I'm sitting here thinking, okay, our 4-year-old, actually both of our kids are in occupational therapy. And we love and adore their therapist, but so much of what they're doing is more of the academic tasks that I don't think they should be able to do right now, like hand grip with the pencil. And like you just said, the shoulder thing, I'm like, oh yeah, our kids have no upper body strength whatsoever. And when we do try to put them on monkey bars, they just fall right off. So it's hard because as the parent, even though we can do all this stuff in our clinic and we if it's someone else's kid, we know exactly what to do. But when it's your own kid and you're with them 24/7, it's like, wait, I totally forgot that existed. Or I totally didn't even think to look there. You're saying so many things that are just kind of blowing my mind right now, even though I know them. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. It's pieces that sometimes, you know, my husband, who is not in the world of education, but the world of psychology, he'll remind me of like, hey, wait a second. Shouldn't we just be letting him play outside rather than all of these things? Yes, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what we should be doing. And that piece was a huge aha for us. So with my son, we started therapy pretty early on. We started, he was diagnosed at age 1, we started therapy thereafter. We were doing occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, both of them 3 times a week. And as I started learning more about movement and how movement really primes the brain for what's needed later, I made a brazen decision to pull him out of therapy and instead let him play way more. So the time that we were devoting to some of those therapy sessions, just getting outside, doing large gross motor play. And we started to see a really dramatically different child in front of us with that. And that was really powerful in you know, I'm reading all of these books nonstop. You know, this is like what I'm reading for fun these days, and Smart Moves and The Well-Balanced Child and all these different balanced and barefoot books that we tend to have kids sitting too much. They're sitting at a chair, they're sitting at a desk, they're doing paper pencil activities. And it's one of those things that we accept in education, but we wouldn't accept anywhere else. So the expectation is we're going to pay taxes at some point in our lives, right? As adults, we're going to pay taxes. We don't ask kindergartners to start practicing for that. We would laugh at that and say, absolutely not. But we do that in education of like, well, you're going to be taking the SATs eventually. So let's go ahead and start now. Let's back that all the way back down. And it's called academic creep. And we used to see this just in elementary school. And now we see this permeating preschools. I just spent some time as director of a play-based, nature-based, so all outdoor, fully free play preschool. And it's incredible to see the foundation that's built there and how prepared children are to go off to kindergarten without ever having worksheets, formal instruction. There's no letter of the day. There's no sound of the day, word of the day, all of the things. There's no calendar time. There's not number lines up on the wall. It all happens authentically through play. So you need really skilled educators to be able to naturally insert that throughout the day and to look for opportunities in children's play to layer that. But to see how prepared kids are when we can take a step back and trust that their body will tell them how to move it in ways that sets them up for the later academics that will happen later. It's really profound. I jokingly say that my son is this like incredible science experiment in a very like loving way, right? Like to see that firsthand. You know, like I mean, he came through this school before I was there as director, and I watched that firsthand. I watched him go into a more academic kindergarten, and there was concern initially from the school that he might not be prepared because he hadn't been there through preschool. And I said, just go ahead and meet him. You'll see what you see. We didn't even share the sensory processing challenges initially. And they're like, oh my gosh, you know, he's reading, he's writing, he's doing all these things, because it will happen when they're ready. But like you said, with the monkey bars, he was a kid who couldn't even think about monkey bars until he was 6 years old. And so that told me a lot. He was a kid whose core was really weak. And that to me is always a sign in the early years. If we see a weak core, he was a kid who was doing that W sitting with the legs behind them for stability. That's always a sign for me as a teacher that if I have a child who doesn't have a strong core, they're going to have issues with midline crossing. And midline crossing has to be really strong and very well coordinated. So essentially what I talk to teachers about is the fact that movement has to be automated. Until movement is automated, where children can do certain tasks, whether that's, you know, crossing the elbow to the knee, they can move their bodies in ways without having to think about it, that academic learning can't happen around it because the brain is so focused on doing that movement. So for example, I can still see some things with my son, speaking of primitive reflexes, that still need to be integrated. When he's writing and really concentrated, the tongue comes out. And I see it, or the mouth does movements that move around and get real pursed. And when I see that happening in the face, it tells me that his movement still isn't automating. He's having to think about the writing that's happening and how he's doing it. So he still needs more whole body movement, not more actual practice with the pen and piece of paper.
Huh. Okay. So one of the things you also talk about in your keynote was types of play and things that we should be doing as Megan and I were talking about this earlier. I had a very freedom seeking childhood. I was outside all the time. I rode my bike around the neighborhood. I was playing catch outside. I was never inside. I watched TV like maybe on Saturday morning cartoons, maybe. But I was outside, you know, came in when the lights came on in the summertime kind of thing, you know, when the sun went down. Versus Megan, I'll let her tell you about hers. But we had, I would say my childhood was extremely free. Megan, how would you describe yours?
Restricted, with like boundaries outdoors. It was, I could play in my driveway, but I couldn't really leave. We lived on a cul-de-sac. I could only go in the circle part of the cul-de-sac, but I couldn't go past that. But my other neighbors and peers could go everywhere in the neighborhood. And so I wanted to ride my bike more, but I couldn't. But whenever I was, in contrast to that, my grandparents lived in a more rural type of area. And whenever I would be there, I had access to everything. So I was outdoors all the time, like no boundaries on their property, but they had 4.5 acres. So I was always outdoors exploring, crawling through stuff, like, and that was my favorite thing to do.
So with that, what we noticed was I'm very much of a risk taker realistically. Like I'm not risk averse, and I'm not like, you know, full on in risk taking. Like gambling will never be something that I like to do, but from a exploring my surroundings, travel, socially, like I will talk to anyone and everyone. And I think Megan is more reserved. And when we were going through your speech, I was like, oh, I wonder if that has anything to do with the fact that we both had completely different play outcomes. Because I was free to do whatever I wanted within reason. Like, you know, my parents knew where I was. And Megan was not at all. So can you tell us more about different types of play and what we should be expecting from kids in an educational system?
What is risky play?
Oh, it's such a good one. It's really interesting, Megan, when you described your play. So Haley, as we're describing yours, I immediately thought in my mind, least restrictive environment. And it was interesting then, Megan, when you described yours, you actually described it as restrictive. And so in education, we try to give children the least restrictive environment because that's where we know they'll have the most space to thrive. And so what the research tells us on risky play, and actually even before that, let me talk a little bit about risky play. Risky play has gained a lot of attention in the United States lately as some schools and organizations have tried to bring back the childhoods that most of us had in our age group that children today don't have.
80s babies.
Does that mean we're going to see playgrounds with 1,000-degree metal slides and some lawn darts come back?
Let's do it.
Yes. You know what I'm hoping will come back? Do you remember those big, heavy metal spinners?
Yes.
Yes.
Are those gone?
Yes, they've taken those off of playgrounds.
Oh, those are my favorite.
When you ask people, they say those are their favorites. Well, guess what? We're getting proprioception and vestibular right there. There's that force to the hands. You're moving in a circle. You're spinning all around.
They were heavy. So you had to build up momentum and work with, you know, hopefully you have friends to play with, like work with friends to help push these giant metal cylinder centrifuges around in circles.
And for kids, it's interesting that you say heavy there too, because what we often find from a sensory standpoint is kids that are dysregulated, light touch is not the type of touch they are craving. It's heavy, it's deep. So having to work really hard and pushing against that merry-go-round is that calming, settling feeling right there. And so we want heavy pieces of equipment. But in our very litigious society, what we've done is say—
Everything is padded and wussy.
Yeah. Everything, you know, we can only go up the slide, not down the slide. The opposite. We can only go down the slide, not up. When we climb up the slide, there's that great proprioception. There's that holding on with our hands. We've taken swings off playgrounds. I have actually seen school playgrounds where they built the fence so that this beautiful tree that was on their school campus is outside of the playground, not inside the playground. Hanging upside down, learning to climb trees is a great way to develop that proprioception and that vestibular. So we see these really sterile, safe play spaces for kids in communities, at schools especially. And so there is these efforts to bring back that more free play that we experienced as kids, that go outside, play until it's dark, then come home. And there's some great research on that risky play. That actually shows the more we allow kids to engage in risks, the better they understand the risks and the less injuries they have. Because learning how to use your body in different ways is a skill. The more we prohibit children from doing that, the more injuries that are going to happen as a result. So we'd be better served giving them the space and giving them the freedom to move in different ways. So much so that in some of the schools where I work in setting up these type spaces, we don't call it risky play. We call it safety play, because we know that children, to stay safe, need to engage in this type of movement and this type of play to stay safe. And it's really cool. If you sit back and watch young children, they always, not always, but most of the time, a huge majority of the time, they're going to move in ways that are just at the edge of their capabilities. They're not going to push that envelope. They know when is enough or when is too high, and that's where they'll stop. And so what we can do is we can give children the language to take risks. And a lot of times we don't do that in classrooms and playgrounds. It's something I had to relearn, not just as an educator, but as a parent, is to stop saying, be careful. And for anyone listening, you know, think about the number of times that you interact with a child. Be careful, be careful, be careful. It just comes out. But what we want to do instead is we want to give language that frames the situations for children to consider. Things like, notice that the log you're walking on is wet. So they're going like, ah, wet, you know, or remember that when it's really wet, it can be slippery. So they're thinking about how they move on that and perhaps what they're using to move on it. My son recognizes that bare feet are a lot more grippy than his slippery rubber sneakers. And so he'll go barefoot. Barefoot is another great way to gain proprioception. But how many schools do you see children barefoot at recess? We see the opposite. No, they must have socks and shoes on. And so allowing children to be barefoot, to learn how to balance on things, the more we let kids interact in that way, the more they're going to develop the self-confidence, the self-esteem that they're able to do and accomplish these things. And then I think that also gives you, Haley, as you mentioned, it gives you that freedom emotionally, that security emotionally to take risks in other areas.
Yeah. I was a social butterfly always. I was never, like, I never fit into one clique in high school. I was friends with everyone, right? And no one was really my exact age in my neighborhood. Most of the kids were a couple years younger, and then others were a few years older. So I always had someone to play with in a variety of age groups. And it was literally me, you know, going to my neighbor's house, knocking on the door, can Jennifer come out to play, kind of thing. And we were all outside as just neighborhood kids. Here where we live, like, we can't even go out. Number one, we can't go outside because it's so hot in the summertime, but there are no children and people are so, like,
which is odd because we live next door to an elementary school. Like, there has to be elementary
school. Yeah. But they don't come out to play. And our kids would love nothing more than to go out and play with other people.
There's never anyone outside here.
It does. I hear what you're saying. We are in a very litigious society. So I think Megan and I are both types of parents who are like, they have to learn. So they're going to hurt themselves at some point. Like, I broke my wrist at 10 years old on the playground at school. I'm fully expecting some sort of broken bones or cuts, bruises, that kind of stuff. They've got to learn where they are in space and what they can do. So I love that idea. Now,
thing too about children of different ages, and that's something that we did as children that we're also seeing diminished these days as well. So it's why I love the Montessori program.
You teach the younger kid and then you learn from the older kid.
That's exactly it. I love that my son's preschool was multi-age classrooms. So not only did they move freely from indoor outdoor, but he was learning from older children. And so considering that when we are setting up play spaces and play dates. And one other thing just to talk about with heat, because we face that same heat here in Hilton Head in South Carolina. There's a beautiful Scandinavian saying, and it's, there's no bad weather. There's just poor clothing. And I love that because when we look at nature schools and forest schools, which really come out of Germany, you think of German winters, they're not temperate at all. And so they're just bundled in appropriate clothing. And when you look at here in the US, the largest numbers and clusterings of forest schools are actually in Illinois. Well, that area is not known for temperate winters either. And so we always think of it's too cold to play outside, but we often forget that it's too hot at the same time. So one of the ways that I always suggest is water play. It's a great loose part, setting up as much water play as possible.
Yeah.
The little mini pools and hoses and sprinklers and water balloons and watering cups. Children will play for hours and hours in water and they'll dunk themselves when need be. So maybe you become the water house.
That is exactly what we do.
Your backyard. And it's amazing. If you build it, they will come kind of thing. And, you know, see if you can attract the kids in the neighborhood.
We can sit in the air conditioning. We put them outside with the water hose.
So that's one of the reasons that we see most schools say they don't want to go outside. It's too hot or it's too cold. It's actually not too hot or too cold for kids. It's the adults. It's that we don't want to go out. And so I think when we begin to see the power of free, unrestricted movement, and, you know, it's impossible to get that in a living room in a small space, but when they have that space to run, climb, I think when we can see the power of it, I think it allows us to, you know, tolerate temperatures we might not ordinarily.
That makes sense. So all three of us could easily get on a soapbox on this next question. But electronics, and I will preface this with, I am very guilty. On Saturday mornings, I want nothing more than to drink my cup of coffee and read a book. And so I will gladly turn the TV on for Saturday morning cartoons. Megan and I both, we restrict screen time. We don't let our kiddos play on our phones or iPads or anything like that. And we have we only maybe do like 2 hours worth at most of cartoons a day. If that, half the time, I think our kids are only on the TV on Saturday mornings. But we are seeing, even in our own clinic, when kids come in, they're immediately given an iPad to try to keep them calm. And everything that you've described about the neurology and the higher executive function for kiddos is being inhibited by that iPad that they were just given, even though that's why they came into our clinic, is for those reasons. So what, as an educator, what are you telling other educators or teachers or parents about the negative implications of so much technology? If anything.
It's so hard, especially in COVID times where we saw schools. So I'll back up by saying, first, as a parent, I don't guilt yourself about it. I think a happy parent sets the stage for the rest of the day. So if that space of having your coffee and having those couple minutes to center yourself, by all means.
Oh yeah, I don't have any guilt of that whatsoever.
Good. Okay. Well, because I think some parents do in that of like, they can't have any. I've heard that it's bad. And so we can't have any ever. And I think, you know, we've got to have balance. Everything is balance in the end.
Yeah.
And I think what's happened is that we have become out of balance for a lot of reasons. One is that we have working families and it's hard to get done all the things we need to do with small children, especially in times of COVID, where we had families who are working at home while their children were doing school from home. And we saw schools that got really excited and all of this money about having been one-to-one schools, which means one device for every child. That always makes me nervous because I personally, as an educator, I don't want my child to have a device at seven. Later on when he's researching and needs that for learning, that's great, but he doesn't have an iPad or a Kindle or video games. He's very upset that he doesn't because he's the only one of his friends that does not. He doesn't have an Apple Watch or, you know, any of those type things because it is so hard to wean off those. Once you get on and you take a child, any child, and then add sensory to that as well too, and pulling that away is like the end of the world. But not just that, it's the idea again of sitting upright with the head not moving. We need to have as much movement as possible for academic foundation. And I think a lot of that has to do with the advertising that's been thrown at us as parents and as educators. So you can't turn on Saturday morning without seeing commercials. I won't name the companies, but you know, your child must have this product. Get on for only 30 minutes a day and they will be reading by three. Well, we're not supposed to be reading by three. If after age seven, we're not reading, then let's have a conversation. But we have these thoughts that if we don't do more earlier, our children will be behind. And this is perpetuated in schools with standardized testing as well too, from testing companies. And so we have more children sitting in front of devices. And I think of education as a craft. It's very personalized. It's very individualized. Every year that I teach it, it should look different than the year before it because I've learned more as an educator. I have different children in front of me. If I'm really customizing my teaching, it's a result of what they're teaching me. And this teaching and learning process is really reciprocal. When you put children in front of devices, it becomes really robotic in the classroom. And I want it to be differentiated. I want it to be customized and really personalized. And so I think we need to continue to skill educators in how to meet these really diverse needs that are in front of us in the classroom to be able to do that without devices. One of the things I work with schools on is changing the paradigm of homework to home learning. And so a lot of schools think like we have to have homework. It's that accountability piece. It's that responsibility piece. I actually think we can teach both of those skills without homework, but that's a separate conversation. I think if we're wanting to have home learning, then perhaps we create a choice board. And some of that home learning is to go outside with a hula hoop, because honestly, that movement of going around the body, that midline crossing, those are the precursors for reading and writing. That's creating the neuro pathways in the brain for the brain to communicate in different ways. And it's creating that really strong foundation. So we create things like that. And then all of a sudden kids come back to school and they're like, I did my homework extra last night because I did hopscotch and I did monkey bars and I did all the different movement type activities. So I think it's just a shift in thinking about how we think about learning, that it doesn't always have to be paper, pencil, or on devices.
Now, is there a way, a lot of what you're saying to me screams preschool, just because, you know, as practitioners, we're always talking about the brain developing before the age of five.
What's making me think like elementary school and how the playgrounds are disappearing?
Yeah.
Like playground time. I mean,
is there a way to, you probably already have the solution, but is there a way to bridge this mode of thinking into the middle and upper years? Because I, you know, thinking back to when I was a biology teacher, I had to get through so much lecture time and expecting the students to have all this knowledge, when in reality, I just wanted to go outside and make them find different types of plants and, you know, do things like that. Is there a way to engage all of this play-based and literally, you know, brain development type of learning in the upper years?
There absolutely is. So the talk that I gave just a week or two ago in Lake Tahoe, my audience was preschool all the way through 12th grade. And it's routinely all the way up, because when we think about neuroplasticity, yes, we're thinking about early childhood development, but the brain doesn't stop. You know, we can't say just because you've hit kindergarten, that's it, the play is gone. But we actually tend to do that in schools. And we really do that in middle school, where I spent time as a teacher as well, that we say, this is serious business. You are now in sixth grade and the play stops here, and we have less and less recess time. When we look at programs that have exceptional outcomes, not just on academics, but the skill foundation as well, when we look to countries like Finland, we look at what they're doing differently. One of the things they do differently, pre-K all the way through 12th grade, is that every hour on the hour, all students go outside for 15 minutes. They have free play for 15 minutes outside. They start the school day outside at recess. They end the school day outside at recess. Some states in America are making some great gains where they're mandating recess time. To me, it's sad we have to even go there with a law to mandate recess. But in the time of children being behind, I'm not sure I buy into the idea of being behind because of COVID. If we're behind, everyone's behind. And then is that really behind? And who decided behind to begin with? If we're not looking at long developmental ranges, I think, you know, it's again that size 4T for all children. And so, but when we start to look at the importance of recess and look at the time, there's some research out there that shows it should be a minimum of 45 minutes. And when we look at most schools, it isn't. It's 15, 20 minutes. And so it's restructuring the day and thinking about what are our priorities. You talked about, Haley, this idea in upper school that you have so much material to cover. And I think we can't cover that. We can put it out there, but it's not going to stick unless we have that time for movement. We need to have those brain breaks, that brain development, that brain foundation that happens through movement, for the learning to stick and stay and transfer, not just learn it for the test on Friday and forget it by Monday, but something that they actually retain. And so by looking at some of those models, Finland also has a shorter school year and a shorter school day. And the results far exceed ours. We have this idea, and I've seen this with a lot of schools following the pandemic, that says we're behind. So we're going to add 10 days to the school year. We're going to go for longer days, and we're going to take away recess, PE, music, art. We're going to take away the specials or the electives for more direct instruction time. And it's the opposite of what needs to be happening.
Yeah. So what's the solution? Like, obviously you're educating educators, which I think is wonderful. But as parents, you know, our listeners are mostly parents. Some of them are teachers. So what is the solution on our end?
It's continuing to advocate. One of the things that I love, a great person to follow if you're a parent, it's a great summer read. Angela Hanscom wrote the book Balanced and Barefoot. And it's a great read, but on her website, she's actually created parent letters that advocate for these type of things. It advocates for recess time for all grades. It advocates for movement time that's unrestricted, that's free. And so we can start to bring that research to schools. We can bring that research to superintendents. I try to partner with superintendents who already have an eye on this. It's no surprise that many of the superintendents that already have an eye on this personally have special needs children. I like to call them special rights rather than special needs. So they already have a sense of this OT and movement, but superintendents that are mandating two recesses a day for all years in school, that are putting as much importance on the movement as test scores, who are willing to stand up for children and really look at the brain development. There's a disconnect between what the research tells us and what we're doing. And so it's time to bridge that gap. The research is there. All of it points in the same direction. If you look at the landmark AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics report in 2019, they actually suggested that all pediatricians write a prescription for play at well visits. because there's such a lack of play, and they have a great overall description of the type of play. And it's this type of risky, large, gross motor play that's unrestricted, that has large windows of time to do it. And so if we follow that research and we follow the neuroscience, it's there for us. There's just a disconnect in what we've always been doing.
Yeah.
So it's time to change that.
Well, I definitely think if we look at the history of the public school situation, in at least in this country, we designed a system to make factory workers, right? If I'm not mistaken. So it's very hard, especially you hit the nail on the head earlier. We have no idea what jobs are going to be like in 20 years. I don't even know what jobs are like now. We're having, you know, great resignation and all that fun stuff happening. So we have this wonderful potential to create a day-to-day lifestyle in whatever fashion we want. But when we're kind of archaic, we see this in every field. Most fields do not keep up with the current research or the current situations. We're usually 10 to 20 years behind, right? Even in our own healthcare field, especially with nutrition. So with people like you, educating people that are in the right situations, like the superintendents, principals, teachers, to create this style or this freedom, I'll call it, of play-based learning, that could set our children up for so many wonderful things. And as a 40-year-old, I want to do it myself. I don't remember anything I learned in school, but I can read like a pro. I went to a liberal arts college, which that's a different story, but I think that's also very important. I'm a critical thinker more than anything, but I can't tell you the facts and figures I learned in, you know, ninth grade history. I have no idea. So if I had time to play in school, I can think of so many more wonderful things that could have happened as a 40-year-old. So.
And that's it. You know, play doesn't have to just be for young children where we're playing with objects. When we talk about play in middle school and high school, it's more of a mindset, and it's approaching the learning in this mindset of playfulness. And we tend to lose that. We get really serious. We create this culture in education that is so driven and so serious. And we pass down that stress. That stress comes on us as teachers. We pass that to children to perform rather than to experience failure. We want kids to do that. Kindergartners are great at failing. Yeah. There's this thing called the Marshmallow Challenge. Have you heard of it?
Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
Okay. This idea. So it's really cool. If you look it up, they gave kindergartners spaghetti sticks and marshmallows and 20 minutes to build the highest tower.
Okay.
And in the room next to them, they gave top CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. And within those 20 minutes, guess who built the tallest tower every time? Absolutely, because they're not afraid to fail because they see failure as the first attempt in learning. But we need to set up our schools to honor that as well, too, that risk-taking, that it's okay to make a mistake, it's okay to try over. The CEOs, what they got wrong time and time again is they wanted it so perfect on paper that they never got to the model. And as soon as there was an issue with what they put on paper, they didn't have the time to redo it. We want kids who are willing to do multiple iterations. That's what's going to bring that critical thinking, that problem solving and the problem posing. That's what's going to bring all of those executive function skills to light, is that playful mindset that we approach. And that comes from each one of us. So even if we're teaching in a school that isn't a play-based school, we can come at it with a playful mindset in our classroom. And that gives some of that agency and that freedom to be able to try and explore in new ways, even if the culture around us doesn't have that.
It's so important, I think, even for us as the people who are listening to this. I'm assuming a kindergartner is not listening to our podcast. But for the moms who are, and for the parents who are in general, I'm a 40-year-old perfectionist. If I don't have something done perfectly, I don't do it. And so that makes me a procrastinator at the same time. So what you just said about how the CEOs didn't win because they were too afraid to fail, basically. I think that's most of us as adults too. So we can even take these lessons and say, okay, you know, failure is not a bad thing, you know? And as far as I'm concerned, you know, one of the things my parents always told me was, you know, you can't be a quitter. So, and one of the things is you only fail if you quit, to me. You might get it wrong the first time, do it again. So that was a lesson that I learned very quickly in life, was you're only a failure if you quit. So I think if we do these things, even in, as an adult, whether it's a hobby, like learn to play piano or learn to play guitar or learn a new language, the playfulness attitude that you're talking about can literally be in any part of our life.
Yes.
And if we don't have that, we're just going to burn out and be depressed adults.
That's exactly it. And you and I are cut from that same cloth. That perfectionist side runs strong throughout me, and I have to regularly keep that in check. My husband actually calls it MVP, and I will freeze on things. For example, a website. I had my website done. It was 2 years before I hit live on it because it wasn't perfect enough. And he kept saying to me, MVP, most viable product. That's what you want. You put it out there, get feedback, and then make changes. Not needing it perfect. Our kids need to hear that lesson. We need to hear that lesson. We need to celebrate effort more than the product. When we get stuck on the product, that's what, you know, stresses us out. And we can learn to be a lot more resilient when we have that playful mindset. There's a ton of research on play, and it's connecting play to resiliency. And if we want to build a resilient community, it's having that playful mindset in everything that we do. So carrying it through all professions.
This is a side note and a topic for a whole podcast, but resiliency is the number one thing Megan and I talk to our patients about most of the time. So if we have patients who seem to get every infection, every possible symptom or side effect happens to them, they have not built up a resiliency, a tolerance. And it usually does stem from they're stuck in a situation. They're so rigid in their thinking. There's no flexibility anywhere in their life. And so it makes for an unhealthy person.
It absolutely does. I mean, you've helped me out of that position. You've helped me to become more flexible in my thinking of learning how to live with autoimmune and how to not feel stuck and how to find the playful side of it. And I think when we can stay curious, it keeps us out of those rigid lines of thinking that it has to be just this way and done in this way, that when we can stay really open and curious as to what might be. And I think children need to see us modeling that. You know, we can say to kids, like, it's great to, you know, it's great to fail and all. And if they see us get upset about every little thing that didn't go right, I mean, they're sponges and they're going to pick up on that.
Mm. Well, this is fascinating. So thank you so much for hopping on here, recording this, and basically telling the world what they need to hear.
It is my pleasure. You two are some of my favorite people in the world. So I would gladly talk these things all day long with you. You've transformed how I think about things, how I can help my son. And I'm grateful all the time that there were other moms who found you before me, who were able to point me to you. And it's changed the trajectory of our wellness at the same time.
Well, thank you for that. I'm going to put them in the show notes, but can you tell people where to find you and if they want to follow you and all that fun stuff?
Absolutely. So the Global Collaborative is my consulting firm, and you can find me on social media. So you can find the Global Collaborative on Facebook, on Instagram, on LinkedIn. And from there, feel free to email or call. I work with schools and organizations, and I'm just always ready to help another parent who might be in a similar situation or entire classrooms. So it takes community and it takes a tribe. So I'm always happy to be part of that.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much again for coming on NutriTots. We can't wait to share this information with the world, and we hope more people learn all about movement as the basis for education. Thanks for listening to the NutriTots podcast. Be sure to like and follow us on your favorite social media platforms and visit our website at NutriTots.com.